order of the day. James, first and second reading. 1. A bill for an act to enable the full participation of Gibraltar in the United Kingdom referendum on whether it should remain a member of the European Union, and to provide for the making of subsidiary legislation in connection therewith, and for matters connected thereto, including amending primary legislation by subsidiary legislation as the circumstances require.
Before we proceed with this bill, I want to make it clear that I have received, as is a requirement, notification from the Chief Minister that this is available with a certain urgency, and that is why we are proceeding with it without the normal 6 week period.
The Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister. I have wanted to move that a bill for an act to enable the full participation of the voter in the United Kingdom referendum on whether to remain a member of the European Union, and provide for the making of subsidiary legislation in connection therewith, and to matters connected thereto, including amending primary legislation by subsidiary legislation as the circumstances require, be read at this time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to enable the full participation of Gibraltar in the United Kingdom's referendum on whether it should remain a member of the European Union, and to provide for the making of subsidiary legislation in connection therewith, and for matters concerned thereto, including amending primary legislation by subsidiary legislation as the circumstances require, be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The European Union Referendum Act 2016. I have wanted to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, the bill of the same name was introduced into the House of Commons on the 28th of May 2015 in order to provide the basis for the referendum on whether the United Kingdom would remain in the European Union. That bill was presented by the Conservative government in fulfillment of its manifesto commitment at the last general election in the United Kingdom. The bill was passed by the UK Parliament and received royal assent on the 17th of December 2015. There are 3 general points in that act that are worth addressing individually. The first is concerned with the timing of the referendum. Section 1C(a) of the Act provides a date by which the referendum must be held. That date is no later than the 31st of December 2017. Honourable members will no doubt be aware that the Prime Minister has not disclosed the possible date for holding the referendum. What he has said is that he would not set the date until after the conclusion of negotiations on the changes that have been sought from the European Union. The UK's position on the changes were set out in a letter to Council President Donald Tusk, dated the 10th of November 2015, which is publicly available on the Italian paraphrase. In that letter, the Prime Minister sets out 4 areas for reform. 1, economic governance. 2, competitiveness. 3, sovereignty. And 4, immigration. I will look at each of them in turn. Economic governance. What we seek, said the Prime Minister, are legally binding principles that safeguard the operation of the Union for all 28 member states, and a safeguard mechanism to ensure that these principles are respected and enforced. Those principles should include the recognition that the EU has more than one currency. There should be no discrimination and no disadvantage for any business on the basis of the currency of the country. The integrity of the single market must be protected. Any changes that the Eurozone decides to make, such as the creation of a banking union, must be voluntary for non-Euro countries, never compulsory. Taxpayers in non-Euro countries should never be financially liable for operations in support of the Eurozone as a currency. Just financial stability and supervision have become a key area of competence for Eurozone institutions, like the ECB. So financial stability and the supervision is a key area of competence for national institutions, like the Bank of England for non-Euro members. And any issues that affect all member states must be discussed and decided by all member states. But country was a question of competitiveness. On this question, he said that the United Kingdom would like to see a target to cut the total burden on business, that the EU should also do more to fulfill its commitment to the free flow of capital, goods, and services. The UK said the Prime Minister believes it will bring together all the different proposals, promises, and agreements on the single market and trade and cutting regulation into a clear long-term commitment to boost the competitiveness and productivity of the European Union and to drive growth and jobs for all. The third point is that of sovereignty. On sovereignty, the Prime Minister said that he wants to work to end business obligation to work together towards an ever closer union, as set out in the treaty in a formal, legally binding, and irreversible way. He wanted a new agreement whereby groups of national parliaments acting together could stop unwanted legislative proposals from Brussels. He wanted to see the EU's commitment to subsidiarity fully implemented with a clear proposal to achieve that. The aim was to get up what the Dutch have said the ambition should be, which is Europe when necessary, national but possible. Mr. Cameron said that the UK will need confirmation that the EU institutions will fully respect the purpose behind the JSA protocols in any future proposals in dealing with justice and home affairs, in particular, to preserve the UK's ability to choose to participate. National security, he explained, was and must remain the sole responsibility of member states, while recognizing the benefits of working together on issues that affect the security of all of them. The first point, Mr. Speaker, was immigration. The Prime Minister said that the UK believes in an open economy, but has got to be able to cope with all the pressures that free movement can bring on food, hospitals, and public services. Right now, he claimed in the letter, the pressures are too great. He wanted to find arrangements to allow a member state like the UK to restore a sense of fairness to the immigration system and to reduce the current very high level of population flow from within the EU into the UK. The Prime Minister argued that it was possible to reduce that flow of people coming from within the EU by reducing the flow that the welfare system exerts across Europe. He proposed that people entering through from the EU must live in the UK and contribute for 4 years before they qualify for in-work benefits or social housing. There was also a need to end the practice of sending child benefits overseas. Mr. Speaker, these were the four areas for reform on which the Prime Minister sought agreement. At the start of a 10-week period, which ends with the referendum itself, the Foreign Secretary has published a report on the outcome of those negotiations between the UK and the EU. The report must also include the opinion of the government of the UK on what has been agreed. In the same time frame, a second report must be published, which contains information about the rights and obligations that arise under European Union law as a result of the UK's membership of the EU. This report will also contain examples of countries that do not have membership of the European Union, but which have other arrangements. A description of such arrangements for each country must also be given. Both reports must be laid before the UK Parliament. They will be available electronically as factual information to voters in the United Kingdom and in the Volta. The referendum would then follow at the end of that final 10-week period. Mr. Speaker, having covered the background in the first general point, I move on to the second one, which is the actual question to be put at the referendum. The UK Bill, when first printed, provided that the question should be, should the United Kingdom remain a member of the European Union? However, the Electoral Commission was concerned with the balance of the question, which is considered being potentially biased towards producing a stay in Europe results. The wording of the question was subsequently changed to, should the United Kingdom remain a member of the European Union or leave the European Union? The alternative answers to our question, as they will appear in the ballot paper, are, one, remain a member of the European Union, or two, leave the European Union. The third general point, Mr. Speaker, and it is a point that most directly concerns the House, is that the Act makes provision for the enfranchisement of Gibraltar. The United Kingdom went to the polls on the 7th of May 2015, and the outcome was a majority Conservative government. This meant that the EU referendum passed from being the policy of the Conservative Party to the policy of the UK government, and the special officials could commence to engage on the subject. It therefore became clear that the UK referendum on EU membership was going to be taken forward. I think no effort was spared on our part to lobby for the inclusion of the broadfare in the fund plan. My humble friend, the Chief Minister, raised this matter with London a number of times. The argument that the outcome of the in-house referendum would have a considerable impact on the broadfare proved to be a compelling argument. The United Kingdom agreed to the inclusion of the broadfare in their referendum. The Chief Minister asked me to chair a working group of officials. The first such substantive meeting between the UK and Gibraltar government took place by secure video link on the 2nd of June of last year, under a month after the UK election. There have been several meetings in London with UK officials from both governments. I'm sure that we will have a further debate on the merits, but at this stage I wish to limit myself to stating that the government is very pleased that Gibraltar has been emphasized in such a clear and unequivocal basis, for which we must thank the Prime Minister David Cameron and the Minister for Europe, David Livingstone. Mr. Speaker, I now move on to the mechanics of the enfranchisement itself. The House will know by now that, as is the case with the European parliamentary elections, voters in the referendum will be allocated to regions. And in the case of the voter, our vote will be taken into consideration alongside the vote in the southwest region of England. As an aside, during the passage of the bill in the House of Lords, in particular, the date of voting at the referendum became an issue. Without wishing to enter into our debate here as well, it should be noted that the age of voting at the referendum is now set at 18. In the European parliamentary elections legislative package, Gibraltar's legislation is effectively limited to the provision of the Gibraltar register. On this occasion, HMGOG has not only been consulted, but we have actively participated in the drafting process both at a political and at a technical level. To that end, our drafting team has, over the last few months, provided advice and feedback on the provisions in the UK bill relating to the voter. Similarly, the bill before the South today has been produced in close consultation and cooperation with the UK team. The government is grateful for the access that has been given to our officials. Given the positive feedback we have had from the UK, we hope that should similar circumstances arise in the future, HMG will engage with the voter and the officials in the same positive manner. It would appear to reflect a genuine and positive desire to assist the enfranchisement of Gibraltar on behalf of officials of Her Majesty's government in the United Kingdom, once the political direction had been given. It is not always the case that the proposed legislation emanating from the Westminster Parliament that has a bearing on life in Gibraltar is subject to such close consultation. The UK side included the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, which was and is the lead department, and the Cabinet Office. Mr. Speaker, I also want to place in record the government's thanks to the Gibraltar team, in particular to the Attorney General Michael Yannock, whose expertise in such matters is well known to all of us in this House, and to Paul Peralta and Nadia Cicarella Parodi, who coped tirelessly with drafting work, with interminable meetings and voluminous email correspondence, all of which against the background of considerable pressure from tight deadlines. In our discussions with HMG, one of the matters which we agreed was to mirror the UK's legislative framework and timetable. As far as the timetable is concerned, with amendments being moved in Westminster up until the very final moment, our drafters have had a very tight window in which to operate. It is for that reason that the earliest opportunity of the government had in which to publish this bill was December 24th. That is, listening down the honourable friend, the Chief Minister, to bridge the amount of time in which the bill could be taken by the House, is a direct result of the requirement to meet the deadline and the timetable set in the United Kingdom. Mr. Speaker, from an early stage, aware that those timings are always going to be tight, one of the earliest policy decisions that had to be taken was whether to create a new register for the EU referendum or to use an existing one. But the prospect of the general election in late 2015 provided for an up-to-date register, the terms of the franchise of our own elections and the terms of the franchise for the EU referendum are both different. Our European parliamentary elections register, however, contained the majority of the eligible persons, including the Irish nationals within the UK government, extended voting rights. Therefore, could the policy be sufficient to use the European parliamentary elections register as a basis for registration for this referendum? Turning now, Mr. Speaker, to the specifics of the bill. Clause 1 and 2 provide for the usual introductory matters. Clause 3 is a purpose clause, which is which, as the heading suggests, sets out the concept in which the bill is to be conceived. Closely one formally sets out some of the details which I have already alluded to, namely that the Maliki government of Gibraltar agreed to participation in the UK's referendum and to the mechanism to make that participation possible. Subclause 2 explains the legal framework which has been applied, and perhaps I can explain it better again in less technical legal terms. The speaker, the basis upon which persons in Gibraltar will be able to vote in the referendum is set out in the UK's Act. That Act requires that a person be registered in the Gibraltar Register for European parliamentary elections. There is a test that needs to be met in order to be eligible. That test that the person registered in the register is either a Commonwealth citizen or a citizen of the Republic of Ireland. By relying on the European Parliamentary Elections Register, Gibraltar's European Parliamentary Elections Act of 2004 is engaged. In the circumstances, the bill provides for the adaptation of the framework to accommodate the EU referendum. Clause 5 provides a power for the making of subsidiary legislation. This power is required in order to give the government the tools with which to respond in legislative terms to any circumstances which may arise. If the act is passed by our parliament, it is our intention to invoke these powers to make subsidiary legislation to provide for some procedural matters. We have adopted the working title, the conduct rules. Unlike the European Parliamentary election, the Gibraltar and UK government agreed that Gibraltar would also be passing this legislation. The kind of issues that fall under the conduct rules relate to matters such as notices that will be published in connection with the poll, the official marks to be used, the issue of poll cards, the provision of polling stations, absent and postal voting, and the count. Clause 6, Mr. Speaker, as I have already explained, the UK referendum Act 2015 requires that a person be registered in the Gibraltar European Parliamentary Elections Register. Given that reliance on the European Parliamentary Elections Register, the clause 6 borrows the European Parliamentary Elections Act 2004 for the purposes of the referendum. This borrowing, therefore, requires that certain aspects of the 2004 Act be modified. This is necessarily a complicated process, but we have attempted to bring as much clarity as possible by inserting the amendments in the first schedule and then actually setting out the legislation as amended in the second schedule. Mr. Speaker, I have given notice that the administrator will be moving a number of amendments, and this includes the removal of Clause 7. This Clause 7 has been inserted at the specific request of the UK government legal team, but it seems to ask for it to be removed. Clause 8 is required because the European Parliamentary Elections Act 2004 is being borrowed, and therefore an offence committed under that Act, as amended, is to be treated as an offence under the bill and not under the European Parliamentary Elections Act of 2004. Clause 9 confers jurisdiction in Gibraltar where an offence is committed as a result of a breach of the UK enactment, which has been specifically applied to Gibraltar for the purposes of the referendum. Clause 10 provides for the application of Section 3 of the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011 in cases where there is a breach of both Gibraltar and UK legislation. Section 3 sets out the procedure to be followed where there is a contravention of two or more acts, and this clause ensures that the UK Act falls within this procedure. Mr. Speaker, clauses 11 to 37 are a series of offences and procedural matters that are set out in the UK's Representation of the People's Act 1983. That Act does not apply to Gibraltar in the context of the European Parliamentary election. Specifically relied upon by the UK and modified by them for referendum purposes, we have reproduced the relevant provisions as a matter of Gibraltar law, and in compliance with our commitment to mirror UK procedures and UK law. The nature of the offences are those which are commonly found in elections. Indeed, most included within the corpus of our own domestic election laws. Offences under the clauses include voting more than once, tampering with a ballot paper, issuing imitation poll cards, publication of exit polls before the poll closes, and breaches of secrecy. Mr. Speaker, I have given notice of a further amendment that I will be moving at committee stage. That entails the insertion of a new clause 27A. Discussions with London have continued after publication of the bill. And in this instance, we have been asked to inspect this code, which is aimed at broadcasts from outside Gibraltar and the UK, which seeks to influence the vote in Gibraltar. Clause 38 is what is referred to as a sunset clause.
Let us hope that after this short and avoidable research, we are able to conclude on our business this afternoon as efficiently as possible. So, Joseph Garcia, I have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Okay, so I mentioned Clause 11 and 37 and the offensive and procedural matters which I laid out there. So, I move on to. I'll go over that again because I'm not sure what's been recorded for the purposes of the sunset and it hasn't. So I'll start again with you see that clauses 11 to 37 are a series of offensive and procedural matters that are set out in the UK's representation of the People's Act 1983. That act does not apply to Gibraltar in the context of the European parliamentary elections. Since it is relied upon by the UK and modified for referendum purposes, we have reproduced the relevant provisions as a matter of Gibraltar law, and in compliance with our commitment to mirror UK procedures and UK law. The nature of the offences are those which are commonly found in elections, and most of which are included in the corpus of our domestic election laws. Offences under these clauses include voting more than once, tampering with the ballot papers, issuing imitation poll cards, publication of exit polls before the poll closes, and breaches of secrecy. Mr. Speaker, I have given notice of a federal amendment that I will be moving and submitted today that details the insertion of a new clause 27A. Discussions with London have continued after publication of the bill, and in this instance, we have been asked to insert this clause, which is aimed at broadcasts from outside Gibraltar and the UK, which seeks to influence the vote in Gibraltar. Clause 38 is what is referred to as a sunset clause. As far as Gibraltar is concerned, the act will be spent once the referendum is over, and this clause causes the act to be repealed 12 months after the referendum. In other words, the act will repeal itself. In the unlikely event that there are any proceedings or any rights that are enforceable at the time of repeal, those proceedings or rights shall subsist. Mr. Speaker, I will already refer to the first schedule and simply would restate that the purpose of it is to amend the application of the European Parliamentary Elections Act 2004 for the purposes of the referendum. The second schedule reproduces the entire European Parliamentary Elections Act 2004 as per the amendments affected by the first schedule and should be of practical value to any reader. Mr. Speaker, if I recommend the bill to that Parliament, I would like to say that this bill is important because of the implications for Gibraltar that attend to the outcome of the referendum. It is extremely possible by the reflection of the level of regard that the Maltese government in the UK has to the rights of the people of Gibraltar that have been included in what is the United Kingdom's referendum, even though we are not a part of the United Kingdom. The bill also reflects the level of detailed and close cooperation that can and should exist between officials from both governments. Mr. Speaker, I commend the bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles or amend for the bill? Honourable Mr. Roy Clinton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have the honour to speak to this side of the House, having consulted closely with an honourable colleague, Mr. Anna Keaton, and his citizen colleague, Philip, the professional lawyers, as to the principles of this. I think, speaking generally, from this side of the House, we obviously welcome the vote of inclusion in the UK Referendum Act. On what is, as reported in today's Chronicle, UK Prime Minister Davos said, it is a remarkably important generational question to Britain and to Europe, and obviously no less to the world. The Honourable Member opposite has gone through the reasoning for the referendum in the UK seeking and the questions that the UK Prime Minister is seeking
so concession is not the right word, but amendments or changes to the UK's relationship with Europe on those four areas. But I think the rules are it's important that we participate in this referendum and that we get our view across as well. I'm conscious that a lot of work has gone into this, both by the members of Oxford and obviously the legal drafting team and various individual assistants. We, however, in this side of the house, obviously, have had limited notice, but we appreciate the importance of it. We'll do everything we can on our side to expedite the process. If I may, talking about the bill itself, what might be unusual for me, having spent many years examining legislation, certainly local legislation, but the interaction between the UK legislation and local legislation. And I across the parliament time, was thinking about me earlier this week, the draft for the UK European Referendum Act 2015, and also the science notes that go with it. Now, I'm also conscious that the amendment that is in Borkley's House, or rather the bill that's in Borkley's House, is needed to facilitate the mechanics of the referendum, or the actual mechanics of how the referendum will be held. And also, I'm happy to be corrected if I'm wrong in that assertion. What I would like to raise, or perhaps put out for discussion, is that there are matters in the UK Act which, as it were, precede our Act, or it could be that we may not be aware or conscious of an individual because they are formed part of the UK legislation and also our domestic legislation. And I think, just by way of example, the idea of the Electoral Commission and their role in determining who are permitted participants in the referendum, and this is in the example note, Schedule 1, different campaigning and financial, paragraph 2 says that Gibraltar established political parties which are not recognised in the UK and therefore not falling in Section 54 2AC, including Gibraltar Social Democrats, Gibraltar Social Labour Party, Liberal Party of Gibraltar, are eligible to become permitted participants by virtue of Section 54 2AG of 2009. But these are obviously technical clauses, but where we're looking at in the bill the mechanics of the referendum as applied in Gibraltar, my concern is that we shouldn't lose sight that there is obviously the UK referendum act and how that will interact with us in Gibraltar and how it will affect us. And this may be beyond the remit of this discussion, and again, I'm happy to be corrected. But for example, the element where the report on substantive space is required to be tabled in the UK Parliament, obviously, this bill will not cover that. More necessarily, in fact, with the conduct rules, which will be done by subsidiary legislation, how people in Gibraltar would go about either setting up their own yes or no campaign, or how they go about becoming participants or committed participants for the purposes of the Electoral Commission, how the rules of funding to be applied in Gibraltar, again, maybe that will be covered by the conduct rules and various other matters. So, as I said at the beginning, we are happy to work with the government on this bill to make it a good piece of legislation, and I'm grateful to the honourable member for having had a discussion on one of the calls we actually formed with. But perhaps we could add some colour to how we would envisage the maximum, not just the actual undertaking of the referendum, but the key leading up to the referendum and the putting of the question, and how we in Gibraltar will be kept abreast of what is said in the UK Parliament, taking the papers and other matters, so that people in Gibraltar are properly prepared when it comes to considering the question.
Does any other honourable member wish to contribute at this stage? The honourable deputy minister.
Mr. Speaker, this bill deals with what is, of course, as we all recognise in this House, a seminal issue for our community.
a seminal issue that calls for a decision. Once the British Prime Minister calls a referendum in which we are to also vote with the rest of the British people. The other member of the is right. The Prime Minister said yesterday that this is a generational decision. In fact, it is exactly how I described it on Tuesday when we received His Excellency the Governor in this House. It is such a generational decision. It is such a seminal decision for this community. But it is almost a sine qua non that most of Altairians feel intrinsically that Gibraltar and the United Kingdom should remain a part of the European Union because of the importance that the European Union plays in our lives. Other members may or may not know that one of the most compelling arguments put in the case of Matthews in the Court of Human Rights, which the Voltairians won, because we were not given it by Britain, won the vote in the European parliamentary election, was that the amount of legislation which Gibraltar had to pass into law and which originated in Brussels and in particular then already making its way through the European Parliament that was to become, as a result of the Matthews case, in legal terms, a legislature, was growing by the day. And indeed today, this House very often deals with European directives that are becoming law or the amendment of existing Gibraltar legislation, which requires change because of European laws requiring those changes, sometimes even updating earlier European laws. The Prime Minister said something else yesterday in Davos at the World Economic Forum. Asked by a French journalist whether he felt European, Mr. Cameron said that he felt deeply European and that in his view, Britain has a European destiny. But Mr. Speaker, I think everyone in this House too would associate with those words in terms of feeling deeply European and believing that Gibraltar with Britain has a European destiny. Mr. Speaker, but when the time comes for a decision in that respect, Gibraltar must form part of that decision-making process. And from the moment that it was mooted, that there might be, as part of the Conservative Party's policy at the last British general election, the possibility of a referendum on the United Kingdom remaining or exiting the European Union, the political machinery of the government moved into high gear to ensure that Gibraltar would form part of that moment of decision. And Mr. Speaker, what many might have thought was going to be a battle for enfranchisement was absolutely nothing of the sort. It was no battle at all. It was instinctively the Prime Minister knew and felt that Gibraltarians should also vote in that referendum. And his commitment and the commitment of David Livingstone, even before they had won the general election in the United Kingdom in May last year, was that Gibraltar should form part of the franchise when the time came. And true to their word, no sooner had the United Kingdom seen a majority Conservative government take over the reins in Westminster that we were following this issue up, and the Prime Minister and David Livingstone were being true to their commitment to the government and people of Gibraltar that we would vote in any such referendum. But if you can imagine that is evidence of the very strong relationship of partnership that today Gibraltar enjoys with the United Kingdom at a government level, as a result of the very hard work we have done to ensure that there are strong personal relationships with politicians and with officials in the United Kingdom who work with the government of Gibraltar. And Mr. Speaker, very often working together in the best interests of Gibraltar and to give effect to the wishes of the people of Gibraltar in consonance with wider British foreign policy interests. Mr. Speaker, this bill is a complex piece of work. It is a complex piece of work that interfaces with a very complex British Act, the House in its previous session, so that we produce a referendum act, which is part of the manifesto commitment of the parties then and now sitting on this side of the House, to ensure that any future national referendum organized in Gibraltar could not be attacked, as our last one had been, as a referendum which did not have legal cover. Intellectual enemies of Gibraltar have sought to challenge both our previous referenda on that basis. They will not be able to challenge a future referenda on any such basis. This referendum is different, though. This is not just a referendum in Gibraltar. It will be a referendum in Gibraltar at the same time as a referendum in the United Kingdom. The referendum here will be part of the referendum organised by the United Kingdom. The votes of Gibraltar will be counted with the votes of the United Kingdom. Mr. Speaker, if the United Kingdom is on an anthem, who's to say that 22 or more thousand votes might not tip it in one direction or another? Sometimes, in European parliamentary elections, because of proportional representation, the number of people voting in Gibraltar can mean that extra seat for one party or another. We may not hold the balance of decision in respect of the results of this referendum, but, Mr. Speaker, we will participate in it. And the method and manner of our participation is that which is now set out in this bill, which the Deputy Chief Minister has been working on with the team that he and I put together. All credit to the Deputy Chief Minister for what has been an intense piece of work over an electoral period, Mr. Speaker. Very often, members of the public don't see that while politicians are out campaigning, those that campaign from the government benches continue to work on government business. And I know that this is a bill that was occupying the Deputy Chief Minister, even whilst he was also out energetically campaigning, and also before and after the general election campaign, energetically dealing with all the other matters that are on his desk. He has cleared the detail and policy with me in a manner that I think Gibraltar can be proud of and can realise how lucky we are to have available that sort of talent that Dr. Garcia brings to the parliament. I want to add Dr. Garcia's remarks of thanks to the head of the Government Legal Office drafting team, Dr. Lepa, who is in Parliament today to assist members in any queries they may have during the committee stage, and the hard and excellent work that I've seen firsthand of Nadia Isabel, under the close scrutiny of the Attorney General, who before taking that post was the government's chief legal advisor and is principally the man who understands European law best in Gibraltar. Gibraltar could not have been better served than with the team that I was happy to be able to put together to deal with this matter. Mr. Speaker, my commitment to the Prime Minister and to the Minister for Europe has repeatedly been that Gibraltar would not stand in the way of David Cameron being free to call a referendum at the time of his choosing when he felt it was most appropriate, because Gibraltar might not have complied with the requirements of having in place the legislation necessary to do the very complex exercise we are going to do, which is to be holding a vote in two different places at the same time, and with different laws governing those two different places. So we need to put our laws entirely on the same page for that moment when the people of the world and the people of the United Kingdom together are going to be free to express their will in respect of the continued membership of the United Kingdom of the European Union. So the people will have to be free of foot. The United Kingdom Act became law in December, and we have to be ready then, having seen the United Kingdom crystallise its views. And honourable members who have been following the debate on this matter will have seen that there has been a lot of politics in the United Kingdom about this bill. There have been issues in the Lords, and then there have been issues back in the Commons, and there is now a British Act of Parliament, a UK Act of Parliament, which we can now dovetail from. And we will now, therefore, Mr. Speaker, be ready as a result of having certified the Spirit of Wisdom in January, with an act, if this house passes this bill, that will enable us to stay to the United Kingdom, subject to whatever administrative arrangements may have to be put in place, and such other regulations and subsidiary legislation as may be necessary, and perhaps even the Speaker potentially reserving the fact that we might have to come back, and even a member of the person, although there is a power to do so already by the subsidiary legislation, we will be ready should the Prime Minister decide to call that referendum. The Prime Minister in Davos yesterday also said that he was not in a hurry to do a deal in February 2017. But if he does, Mr. Speaker, and if he believes that this is the right time to call the referendum, then Gibraltar will not be found wanting for not having done the work we needed to do in the time that we had to do it to bring the bill to the Parliament. Mr. Speaker, I welcome the fact that Mr. Clinton has said from the opposition benches that he will work with the government to produce a good piece of legislation. As I may say, Mr. Speaker, I think it's already a very good piece of legislation that does what it needs to do to ensure that the people of Gibraltar can have the vote they need to have to express their will in respect of this seminal generational issue. How are the people of Gibraltar going to be kept informed of what's happening in the United Kingdom? What is going to happen on the ground here? These are all the issues, Mr. Speaker, on which we need to ensure that the politics that is now ongoing in the UK are reflected somehow in Gibraltar, that people understand the choices that they have to make. I believe, from what I've seen so far, Mr. Speaker, that all political parties in Gibraltar will be campaigning for Gibraltar to remain within the European Union. But the people of Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, they have access to many new sources. They are very well informed indeed, and I believe, Mr. Speaker, they know what is at stake and exactly what it is that they have to choose between. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, I have no doubt that with the instruments in place for them to express their will in the referendum with the United Kingdom, they will, when the time comes, express the view that the United Kingdom and with it Gibraltar should remain within the European Union. Speaker, I think the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister is absolutely right to commend the bill to the House.
The Honourable Deputy of the Opposition. Mr. Speaker, thank you very much. Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister, as has been noted in this House, has described the referendum on Europe as a generational decision. And I think that for Gibraltar, it is a generational decision, but it's much more than just a generational decision. For many areas of business, being in Europe is existential, it's an existential issue. For part of the finance sector, being outside Europe would have a devastating effect, and therefore a knock-on effect for revenue that comes into the government. And although it was inevitable that a debate in the United Kingdom would occur about whether the United Kingdom stays in or out of Europe, and that this referendum could be seen as being something that was inevitable for some time because of that debate that was ongoing for many years as to whether the United Kingdom wanted to remain in or out. And in many parties, in the Labour Party, in the Conservative Party, there were large parts of those parties that were Eurosceptical in nature to a lesser or a greater extent. There has never been a debate in Gibraltar about whether Gibraltar wants to remain in Europe, as to whether Gibraltar wants to redefine its relationship in Europe. Gibraltar has always wanted to be at the heart of Europe. And therefore, whilst yes, it is a generational decision, it is a decision, nonetheless, that Gibraltarians would have preferred to have done without, because we would have preferred to have done without this debate and this referendum, because Europe is of paramount importance to this community. And although there may be some who may say that it would have been both unjustified and unjust
for the United Kingdom and for Mr. Catford, David Cameron, to have left Gibraltar out of the referendum that's going to be taking place in the United Kingdom. I think it is appropriate that everybody should thank the commitment that the Prime Minister in the United Kingdom and also the Minister for Europe have shown to Gibraltar, not only in the decision that he has made to include Gibraltar in the referendum, but also in the commitments that his government, both now and also as part of the coalition with the Liberals, showed Gibraltar over the last 5 years. And it has to be said, it contrasts sharply with the inherently colonial views that were expressed by the leader of the Labour Party recently, Jeremy Corbyn, in relation to Gibraltar. And although, as somebody that was a member of the Labour Party in the United Kingdom, but never voted Conservative, always voted Labour when I was in the United Kingdom, as a student and also as a barrister, I feel absolutely justified that since I returned to Gibraltar in 2000, I have always supported the Conservative Party, because the Conservative Party over the last 16 years has always supported Gibraltar. And at the end of the day, for Gibraltarians, it's not about ideology when it comes to Europe and our relationship with political parties in the United Kingdom, certainly the way I see it. It's about how those political parties react in relation to Gibraltar, defend Gibraltar, and stand up for the rights of the people of Gibraltar. And that is why it is also right that in our own way, and all the political parties in Gibraltar have tried to do so, establish some personal relationships with individuals within political parties in the United Kingdom, and we have, over a number of years, done that with the Conservative Party in the United Kingdom, that have still supported Gibraltar, and both myself and also my friend, Elliot Phillips, have attended the Conservative Party conference on a number of occasions. I end by also recognising the hard work that has gone into this bid, not because it's particularly complex, it's one of the longest bills that we have, the largest bills that we have seen presented before this Parliament, but because of the complexity of the subject and also the time frame as well that this piece of legislation has had to be produced. The United Kingdom has had far, far more time to produce legislation, to then debate it. It's taken 6 months from the time that the bill was presented in the House of Commons to the time that it received assent. The Honourable Gentleman said, I think, the 17th of December of last year. And this has been produced in a far, far shorter time frame, and therefore I, too, on behalf of the Her Majesty's Opposition, wish to congratulate the Gibraltar team, and in particular Paul Berardsa, whom I know very well from the time that I was Minister for Justice, and the very good quality work that he produced when I was heading that department as a Minister, and also Her Majesty Ferrello, whom the Honourable the Minister also mentioned. So I have absolutely no hesitation, as indeed has already been said by my honourable colleague, Mr. Will Clinton, in supporting this bill.
Anybody else please to participate in the second reading of the bill? I will call upon the mover to reply. The Honourable Dr. Joseph Griffin.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. First of all, I'd like on behalf of the government to welcome the support of the opposition for the bill. It is very useful to have met up with the Honourable Mr. Clinton and to have discussed some of the issues which will be reflected in some of the amendments when they were presented at the session during committee day. John Member referred to the fact that a number of these issues are contained in UK legislation, and he's correct, indeed they are. And so the reason for that is that it's the UK referendum. It isn't a joint referendum, it's the UK referendum, and it's one in which we are very grateful to be able to take part and to
by the Electoral Commission, they published detailed guidance in relation to almost every aspect of the referendum. But the public knows that information role would fall on the clerk in its capacity as, I think, the presiding officer, counting officer, in the referendum for the voter. So public information notices and adverts are listed through the clerk. And also, as my understanding, the Chief Minister mentioned, this is a top media issue in the United Kingdom. So anybody sitting on the news, the BBC or whatever, will be well informed of the detail of things that they develop. And indeed, the local media as well, obviously, will pick that up. In relation to the comments made by the honourable member, the leader of the opposition, certainly it's correct, and there is no debate, I think, in the vote as to whether we should be in the European Union or not. I think the results are claimed by UKIP in the vote locally in the European parliamentary elections are saying that, and the people here tend to want to belong to Europe. And obviously, I think our argument is more about ensuring that Europe allows us to belong with the same rules and on the same level playing field as everybody else. I mean, that's probably where we have the debate. And I just give way to Mr. Minister, who I'm grateful for that, at that moment where the Honourable Gentleman is dealing with the words of the member opposite. But I think it's dealing with one of the issues that the Honourable Gentleman alluded to. He said that this is more a more than just a deliberation of business. He said it was essential for some businesses. But I understand that. I think it can be a very difficult economic model for some businesses, which of course is not within the European Union because of the way that business models are determined today, because we have access to a single market. And therefore, of course, there is an opportunity that people are pursuing. But can I just counsel as we start the process of having this debate and expressing views in this respect? Can I counsel that we don't pretend that the United Kingdom exiting the European Union would be existential for developers? Now, I wrote an article for a publication, the editors of which decided that they should title it almost in those terms, and I took great exception at that, because we should not for one moment give our enemies the sucker that if the United Kingdom were to make a decision, which is contrary to that which we all seem to be expressing we'd like to see the United Kingdom take, that Gibraltar might somehow be in a position where we were having to consider our very existence. There would have to be a recasting of the economic model, there would have to be very serious thought given to what relationship we could have with the European Union, even if the United Kingdom had a different one, our relationship with the United Kingdom might have to be different, hence why it's important to start considering now constitutionally what those relationships might be and not wait for any such decision to affect. But let us not allow anyone to think, and I'm not suggesting the Honourable Member of the Assembly, he said this about some businesses, but let nobody go away from this place thinking that our survival, economic, cultural or social, is dependent on membership of the European Union. Our current economic model is, and we would have to work very hard to find a different economic model, and it would be very challenging. But there's one thing that the people of Gibraltar are good at doing. It's dealing with the worst adversity and turning it into a crime. Evacuation, closed frontier, point of consumption tax. You know that, Mr. Speaker, this community works together and ensures that we not just survive, we thrive. And nobody should think that any difference is going to happen in respect of a membership of the European Union through the United Kingdom or otherwise. Because the other way, instead, there'd be no debate in Gibraltar about Europe. Well, Speaker, we kicked off a debate in Gibraltar on the subject. I know that you felt it was just limited, but we kicked it off and we're working very hard on a review of the economic model and whether or not membership of the Common Customs Union and the Excise Union, something which was rejected in 1972, or entered on the 1st of January 1973, whether that decision is still the right one today. I think those who made the decision in 1972 made absolutely the right decision, and the success of the broad term, our thriving economy, is of course in great measure down to the benefit that the past, I can never forget how long it was, 43, almost 44 years since then, because they made the right decision. But going forward,
we did have the two things that if I were to tell you that that decision was reviewed subsequently on at least two other occasions over the years in the early CRN government.
This began very briefly. I've seen the papers, and they are very informative, and have led some of my thinking of the work that we have been doing to ensure that we review, trying to use, where applicable, the same criteria so that we are measuring economic apples with economic apples. But, Mr. Speaker, today, we need to ensure, and Brexit may have been a catalyst to this, but it's not the only issue, that the Europe we choose is the Europe that is the right Europe for the next 30 to 40 years. And, Mr. Speaker, the material available in respect of accession discloses that when those derogations were agreed, it was envisaged that Gibraltar would eventually form part of even those areas from which Gibraltar had derogated. On the basis that Gibraltar then, just to give people a flavor of some of the logic, Gibraltar then would have been a European economic community, as it then was, island at the bottom of the Iberian Peninsula, with the European Union commencing again at the Pyrenees. But that eventually, people thought Spain would become democratic, would join, etc., and when we were part of a Europe which was all in the EEC, Gibraltar would join. Well, in fact, Gibraltar has not chosen to join, it's been right not to choose to join, and that is part of the prosperity that we enjoy today. But we still have to continue to review those issues. We able to hear him make some remarks about the leader of the Labour Party, Mr. Jeremy Corbyn, in relation to those points?
Just to say to the Honourable, I'm very glad that, listening to him, that he's outlining the issues that he's been considering in relation to in the last 3 years. I would have expected him to have done so, and I'm very glad, certainly on behalf of the opposition, that he's doing so. Could I also invite him that perhaps at some stage, when his itinerary allows, that perhaps he could have a meeting with me in order to brief myself and perhaps one member of my team in relation to those issues in a little bit more detail than perhaps he could in this Parliament, because it may involve issues that perhaps he may not want to canvass openly. But I invite him to do so. There is a meeting in this House that calls upon us to basically work together in relation to this, and I'd be grateful if the Honourable Chief Minister could do that at some stage.
I think I will have no difficulty in doing so, but this is a work in progress. There's very little to brief on at this stage. And I'm referring to Speaker, I do look forward to working with him when the time comes on these issues, but you mustn't think that things which are existential, generational, and seminal suddenly are fixed. If I meet with him, I take his views, and then I get the answers. I don't think it quite works that way. But I shall take that invitation to treat as a genuine one, and I will look forward to our meeting. The Honourable Gentleman referred to remarks imputed to Jeremy Corbyn on Gibraltar, which is several of those colonial views. He and I will have different opinions of UK politics and of different UK politicians, this one in particular. But can I put it to him, Mr. Speaker, in fact, that Mr. Corbyn has not made any remarks about Gibraltar. Mr. Corbyn's remarks, unfortunate as they were, and I associate myself with everything he has said about Mr. Corbyn's remarks, were about the Falklands. And I associate myself with him in respect of the Falklands. But this is a very, very important issue. Mr. Corbyn has not said anything about Gibraltar. What happened, Mr. Speaker, was that Ms. Emily Thornberry asked a few minutes later about the remarks that Mr. Corbyn had made, reflected her own views, not Mr. Corbyn, in a way that was a little more acceptable than what Mr. Corbyn had said about the Hawkins, but certainly not the standard that one would expect in respect of a modern politician in a democracy like the United Kingdom, reflecting on the rights of people like the people of Gibraltar, the people of the Falklands. And Mr. Speaker, you know, the relationship I am speaking of, because it is a relationship that I have nurtured in government with the Prime Minister and with David Livingstone, is of course therefore a relationship with conservative politicians. And the strength of the relationship Gibraltar enjoys today is enjoyed with conservative politicians. And we have nurtured those relationships, regardless of political label or ideology, in the best way that we could leverage for Gibraltar, and not just as might have been done before, but probably in a way that hasn't been done for 30 years, Mr. Speaker. And I think those are therefore very useful indeed. But I would say this, Mr. Speaker, because he has brought into the debate the issue of Labour or Conservative. I don't know that it was necessary to do so, but he has brought it into the debate, Mr. Speaker. I believe the Labour Party has acted sinfully in relation to Gibraltar, in particular in relation to the joint sovereignty issue in the early part of the new millennium, and in other instances, but has acted absolutely properly and better than any other previous government when it has given us the double lock, which Mr. Peter Kavwana was able to negotiate with Labour ministers. And I believe the Conservative Party has acted honourably and as it should in relation to this matter and in relation to other matters, but it has acted shamefully with Gibraltar in relation to the Brussels Agreement and in relation to the Airport Agreement. Mr. Speaker, swings and roundabouts, I think labels matter little. People matter more. And I praise the commitment of Prime Minister David Cameron to the people of Gibraltar in relation to this matter, in relation to the issues we had with the Partido Popular administration in the year 2012, 13, and 14, and the way that when it has come time to stand up for Gibraltar, he has stood up for Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker. In the same way as Jeffrey Hoon stood up and was counted when the time came and the double lock was agreed. So, Mr. Speaker, I wanted to make those points that I think they were important. And can I just end by saying I found it slightly absurd to simply congratulate two out of a team of four, but I will assume that he wishes to extend his congratulations also to the Deputy Chief Minister for the fine work he has done and to the Attorney General.
Does the Honourable Mover wish to continue with exercising his right to reply?
This is only to say finally that I think the issue that will drive the London debate in the discussion. Yes, I am flattered. Yes, let anybody think that I am doing terrorist in any way, shape, or form, and bearing in mind the convivial way in which these proceedings have been conducted over the last few days, and no doubt over the next few years. And I've actually no hesitation, as I said, that I congratulate the entire Gibraltar team, and that of course includes the only Gibraltar. Mr. Thank you for that. And the reactions are very more flapping like that. Let me now conclude by saying that I think this is what will drive the debate in referendum in the UK, which is Prime Minister's renegotiation criteria and the 4 points I mentioned earlier. And those will drive the debate in discussions in the vote there. They will be very different. And then, whereas here we have issues of staying under the border and in the UK, the debate is going to be centered around the Prime Minister's renegotiation, and that's going to be the case. So, Mr. Speaker, that concludes my contribution.
more honourable members care to read the rules, I'm sure they will discover how liberal I have been in interpreting the rules, where the question of giving away is concerned. But I thought it was very appropriate that I should do so, given. I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to enable the full participation of the voter in the United Kingdom referendum on whether it should remain a member of the European Union, and to provide to the making of subsidiary legislation in connection therewith, and for matters connected thereto, including amending primary legislation by subsidiary legislation, as the circumstances require, be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The European Union Referendum Act 2016. I beg to give notice that the committee stage on third reading of the bill be taken today, if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage on third reading of the bill be taken today?
A bill for an act to amend the Animal and Birds Act, the Honourable Minister for the Health, the Environment, Energy and Climate Change.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Animal and Birds Act be read a first time.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Animals and Birds Act be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Animal and Birds Amendment Act 2016.
The Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill now be read a second time. The Speaker, from determining the political future of millions to microchipping the dogs of a few, Parliament is so diverse. The Speaker, I have the honour to move this bill, to which I have added after some discussion that I had yesterday and the day before with the Honourable Mr. Rama, an amendment which I will refer to later by way of letter. The main purpose of the bill is to require all Belgians to vote to be microchipped. This is something that happens in other countries, in fact, in the UK. It will become law in April. We were going to beat them too, but because we ran out of parliamentary time when the election was called, we had to start this again, so now we won't be ahead of them. The permanent identification of dogs through microchipping has a number of benefits. First of all, it's the most effective means of reuniting strays or stolen dogs with owners as quickly as possible. Secondly, it would be much easier to identify the owner of a dog that has been abandoned by the owner, and thereby to ensure that the owner takes responsibility for his or her dog. And of course, microchipping also facilitates the cross-border and international travel of dogs. The advantage of a microchip over a collar in these scenarios is, of course, that a collar and tag are often left off or slipped off, and collars can also easily be removed from stolen dogs. Permanent identification through microchipping is effective at all times and is virtually impossible to alter or remove. It's important to note that a dog will no longer be able to be registered or licensed unless it has been implanted with a microchip. This restriction is already in place for vaccination. In the case of microchipping, however, we have provided for a grace period until September the 1st in order to give time to owners whose dogs are not already microchipped to ensure that they are. We have also provided for a permanent exemption from the requirement for microchipping where the veterinary surgeon certifies that the implanting of a microchip in a dog will harm it. The Speaker, I also want to point out that this bill provides for the implantation of microchips to be undertaken only by competent individuals, and here is where, in discussions with the Honourable Gentleman opposite, then we have both extended the individuals from a veterinary surgeon exclusively to also a veterinary nurse, acting under the direction of a surgeon, but also tightened it to ensure that anybody who has received instruction on implanting microchips will have done so from a veterinary surgeon and is acting under the direction of the veterinary surgeon, and we felt that that was a tighter resolution to the matter. Lastly, Mr. Speaker, we have taken the opportunity in this bill to tidy up and update some of the existing language in this part of the law regarding licensing officers, for example, by pluralizing where appropriate and vice versa, and we have some discussion about implications of that, and I think we resolve that, and by strengthening the powers to compel the vaccination of a dog
Speaker, I commend the Speaker of the House, and I want to express my gratitude to Mr. Yamas, Mr. Yamas, for his collaboration in this, and certainly in other plans we have to improve our legislation at the time of the day.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? The honourable Mr. Lawrence Yamas.
Mr. Speaker, I am grateful for the opportunity to say a few words in respect of the amendments to this bill late today. Compulsory microchipping of dogs is already a common practice in most countries. Therefore, the principle of this bill is in line with domestic legislation being introduced by other EU countries. It is also already an EU regulation to have dogs microchipped and vaccinated against rabies in order to travel with pets that means dogs, cats, and ferrets between member states under the EU pet passport scheme. So, the effect of this amendment would be to ensure that all dogs, regardless of whether they intend to travel within member states or not, are microchipped and vaccinated against rabies by virtue of their residency in Gibraltar. I am pleased to say that this side of the House shall be happy to support the amendments to this bill as currently amended, and I hereby thank the Honourable Member, Dr. Butler, for the opportunity of working together for the good of this bill and the purpose of this bill. Thank you.
Perhaps it is appropriate at this stage we should congratulate not just the Honourable Lord Chairman, but the Honourable Mr. Roy Clinton for their first intervention during the debate in Parliament and what could be regarded as their maiden speech. May the Honourable Member wish to speak on this bill? I will call upon the mover to reply.
Reiterate that it's a pleasure to have other animal lovers having joined this parliament after the last election, and I now put it to you that, that I commend the bill.
I will now put the question, which is that. I will now put the question, which is a bill for an act to amend the Animals and Birth Act is read a second time. Those in favour, those against, carried.
The Animal and Birth Amendment Act 2016.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice that the committee state and third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Honourable members agree that the committee state and third reading of the bill be taken today.
A bill for an act to amend the Judicial Service Act 2007. The Honourable Minister for Education, Telecommunications and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Judicial Service Act 2007 be read a first time.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Judicial Services Act 2007 be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Judicial Service Amendment Act 2015.
If you speak, I'd like to move that the bill for an act to amend the Judicial Service Act 2007 be read a second time. A version of this bill was first published as Bill 31 for 2015 on the 27th August 2015. Due to the timing of Parliament and the general election, it was not possible to bring this bill before Parliament, and as such, it lapsed before the Parliament was released. The bill was then republished as the current Bill 35 of 2015 on the 10th December 2015 in identical terms. This bill has two separate purposes. The first is to make provision for the Chief Justice to be the head of the judiciary in Gibraltar. These amendments will fulfill the commitment contained in the 2011 TSOP Liberal Manifesto, where we stated, quote, our view is that the head of the judiciary in Gibraltar should be the Chief Justice, as has always been the case, irrespective of who the personal judge may be. Close quote. These amendments have been the subject of consultation with the Chief Justice and the previous President of the Court of Appeals, Sir Paul Kennedy, who had no objection to these changes being made.
and Sir Paul, of course, was the president until October 2015, and was therefore the president of the Court of Appeal when the bill was drafted and first published. The main amendment is the substitution of the current Section 6 of the Judicial Service Act 2007 with a new Section 6. The changes made therein are consequential to the change in the title from President of the Court of Gibraltar to Head of the Judiciary, and reflect that the post will be held by the Chief Justice. There are amendments, there are consequential changes to the Judicial Service Act, where reference is made to the President of the Court of Gibraltar. The changes to Sections 24 and 32 contained therein still contain a consultative role for the President of the Court of Appeal in certain circumstances. The change to Section 37 simply changes the reference to the President of the Court of Appeal regarding disciplinary powers to a resident solely. Changes the reference to President of the Court of Gibraltar regarding disciplinary powers to a reference to the President of the Court of Appeal. This reflects the constitutional role of the President of the Court of Appeal in such matters. The second set of amendments contained in the bill deal with the disciplinary provision of the Judicial Service Act 2007, and in particular regarding the suspension of judicial officers. These amendments have been recommended by the Judicial Service Commission following a detailed analysis by them of the issues they have encountered and may encounter in undertaking disciplinary proceedings against judicial officers. The Magistrates' Government has accepted these recommendations. The amendment containing Subclause 2A brings the language of Section 32 of the Act in line with that of the Constitution and ensures that it is not only the behavior of holders of cumulative judicial office, that is, Supplementary Magistrates, Justice of the Peace, and Registrar of the Supreme Court, that may be examined, but also their inability to discharge the function of office. The amendment in Subclause 2B sets out the power to make a recommendation to suspend such an officer pending the outcome of the proceeding, and the amendment of Subclause 3 allows for the governor to make such interim suspension. Finally, the amendment contained in Subclause 4 ensures that the power of the Judicial Service Commission to make regulations under the Act includes a power to make regulations regarding suspension from office. Speaker, I commend the bill to the House.
Before I put the question, if any honourable members could speak on general principles and merits of this bill. The honourable Mr. Elliot Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, the bill to amend the Judicial Services Act 2007 first needs to be invoked by the Governor's Court to amend Section 6 of the Act to create the office at the head of the judiciary and to make further necessary consequential amendments as the Minister of Justice has described. It is proposed by the Honourable Gentleman Minister for Justice that the Chief Justice shall be the head of the judiciary. Furthermore, the Honourable Gentleman proposes amendments to Section 33 and 37 of the Act, which deal, as he stated, with the discipline of junior judicial officers. Before I set out the position of the opposition, I think it's helpful to pause and reflect on what the opposition position was whilst in government was promoted to the Judicial Services Bill in 2007. The Judicial Services Act, in its current form, was debated in this House, and it's fair to say that it arrived on the table during a controversial time in our judicial history. I do not intend to make further comment on that, save to flag the context. There was a lengthy debate in this House between the opposition spokesman for justice, the Honourable Mr. Gagaro, and the Chief Minister, Mr. Gagaro, as they both then were. The nub of the issue at the time was the creation of the office of the President of the Court of Gibraltar. The rationale of the Chief Minister, Sir Peter Caruana, at the time was that the President of the Court of Appeal was the most senior judge in the most senior court of Gibraltar's own judiciary, and therefore it was, in his view at the time, therefore entirely appropriate for the President to hold the office of presidency of the court generally. The bill before the House at the time underwent considerable consultation with all stakeholders, particularly the Bar Council, Judges of the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice, and the Judges of the Court of Appeal. After the consultation process, the US government accepted the advice of the consultees, which suggested that the day-to-day management and administration of the justice, the administration of Gibraltar, would be retained by the Chief Justice, eminently sensible in my view. The Chief Justice at the time, Chief Minister at the time, hopefully, reminded the House that although Section 3A, gave the president of the court of Gibraltar, namely the president of the appeal, and it was all responsibility for representing the views of the judicial into Parliament. Section 5 also made provision for the rights of both the Chief Justice and the President of the Court of Appeal to make representations to the Minister for Justice and the government on matters that appear to them to be matters of importance to the judiciary or otherwise to the administration of justice in Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, it is fair to say that the bill enjoyed overwhelming support from stakeholders. Those of the members of the who declined to support the bill, ultimately because they felt that the GST government at the time were, to use the words of the government of opposition spokesman for justice, exporting the headship of our judiciary to a non-rebel. It was accepted in the debate by the honourable that Mr. Speaker at the time that neither the 1969 Constitution nor the 2006 Constitution designated the Chief Justice as head of the judiciary. Be that as it may, Mr. Speaker, without wanting to reopen a 9-year-old debate, the side of the House will not oppose the bill to amend Section 6 of the Judicial Services Act. And in fact, on behalf of the opposition, we will support the bill for one simple reason, as is this. But the bill reflects reality and what is going on the ground. The Chief Justice deals with the day-to-day administration of justice, and there are excellent working relationships between the Honourable Mr. Justice Dudley and the judges of the Court of Appeal. And there is a strong, open channel of communication between all of our judges, which has served our community well, and our judiciary is a credit to our community. One point that I would like to give way to the Minister for Justice on is in relation to the point that he makes on the Section 37.3. If I'd like to seek clarification on that, I just mentioned that. My understanding from the amendment that is at on page 865 of the paper states that the Judicial Services Act, which provides a mechanism for the suspension of a junior judicial office holder in the context of maintaining confidence in judiciary. If the Minister of Justice can just explain the rationale for that deletion in relation to maintaining confidence in the judiciary. Can I give way in relation on that point? I only have two
So that he can comment further, because he may not know what it actually means. There is a procedure long going back many years where you give word, explain, and then he continues. Otherwise, you simply speak, he cannot continue.
This is something that I am aware happened during the time when I was not a member of the House. It's become an increasing practice. I have no serious objection to it.
What does that mean, of course, is that when we go into committee, and for each clause, there is an opportunity to debate, discuss the matter at nauseam, that doesn't happen. It can happen then, repeatedly, without any problem. Now, the other thing is, of course, that the Honourable Moore is going to exercise his right to reply. And it is a practice at that stage for the Moore to try to answer any points that have been raised by other members on the general principles and merits of the
I'm grateful for the intervention, by the way, about the Mr. Speaker and clearly Mr. McGreevy, the Minister of Justice, is not going to accommodate that, but we'll continue. Given that we are debating the Chief Justice's head of judiciary, I am sure this whole House will join me in expressing the great sense of pride that one of our own jurists holds the office of Chief Justice, and that he will now be the de jure head of the judiciary and not just the de facto head of the judiciary. On a personal note, and as someone who has appeared regularly before Mr. Justice Dudley, I'm sure the whole House will share the confidence, the respect, and admiration that this side of the House has for Mr. Justice Dudley as the first Gibraltarian Chief Justice.
Again, before I call on any other person to contribute to the debate, may I congratulate the Honourable Radio Phillips on his maiden speech. Does any other honourable member wish to contribute to the second reading of the bill before I call the mover to reply? The honourable leader of the opposition.
I just want to very briefly just say this, that There are occasions, Mr. Speaker, when in politics one takes a position and one listens to the argument from one side and the argument from the other side, and the arguments are very finely balanced. We took a decision in 2006-2007 on the grounds that the Honourable Member, Mr. Elliott, has outlined to have the President of the Court and the senior judge of the senior court in Gibraltar as effectively the head of the judiciary here in Gibraltar. And they took the view that it should be the Chief Justice who was the most senior resident judge here in Gibraltar. And quite frankly, I see the argument on both sides. I think that what has certainly persuaded me that we should be voting in favour of these amendments is that it wouldn't be right, Mr. Speaker, for the opposition, knowing that the government is actually going to, because of its majority, they could get these amendments through this House, of having a situation where we do not support the Chief Justice of the day in becoming head of the judiciary going forward. I think it sends the wrong kind of signal. And bearing in mind that you are talking about very finely based decisions here, we think, certainly, that we should support this particular bill, despite the fact that we took a different position in 2006. So there is absolutely no mixed signals going forward about our support for the Chief Justice and the work that he is doing, which is absolutely first rate in relation to the judiciary here in Gibraltar.
The Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, can I associate myself with those remarks about the Honourable Chief Justice? The rules of procedure of the House say that we should not call into question the conduct of any one of Her Majesty's judges. But I assume that when we do, in order to praise them, then the rules do not affect us in such a way, because it is absolutely right and proper that this is reflected in the fact that Anthony Dudley has reached judicial heights that no Gibraltarian has ever reached before. And that must be a source of huge pride for the whole of this community. Not just that he has reached those heights, but how he discharges his office in the context of those lofty achievements in the judiciary. But if you know, what we cannot do is rewrite history. And what we cannot say is that today we support a measure in this House unanimously. It is not to support the Chief Justice of the day sends the wrong signal, when in fact, that is exactly what happened in 2006. And the reasoning behind what was happening in 2006 was absolutely and utterly transparent. And if people are the one agrees or disagrees with individuals, in the constitutional architecture of the voter, there's not a good reason to move responsibility from one or another. It may be a good reason to seek to remove an individual. It may be a good reason to ensure that less responsibility appertains to that individual in respect of the things which he is doing on day to day, but not necessarily, Mr. Speaker, to change the structure of the administration of justice simply because of issues between one individual or another in the hierarchy of government. Mr. Speaker, that was wrong. That is why I spoke out against it at the time. And that is why now, in the context of the bill, we will be changing that. We did not do it at the first available opportunity, although we were ready to. But, Mr. Speaker, we had a President of the Court of Appeal who himself did not deserve to be removed from the job that he was doing, because he was doing a very fine job. Because this move was not to criticize the marriage or Kennedy, for the work that they have done, which has served Gibraltar well indeed. But the speaker is about putting the legal order back where it was, back where it should be. And because no Chief Minister should ever say again of a Chief Justice, this town wasn't big enough for both of us, as my predecessor said, of the then Chief Justice.
Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
Speaker, just on the question of timing, the Honourable Chief Minister has alluded to this. This was, of course, as I explained, a manifesto commitment from 2011. And clearly became aware that Paul Kennedy would continue to serve as President of the Court of Appeal and consequently as President of the Court of Gibraltar in October of last year. And that is why the bill was published in order to bring it in, as it were, to make a change over to Kennedy Judiciary in the future in Gibraltar when that actually happened. As it happened, we didn't have Parliament at the time, therefore it was not possible to bring in that bill. That is why we are bringing it now, even though there has been a new president appointed since then. But the intention of all time was to make it effective in October following the retirement of Sir Paul Kennedy from office. And as I indicated, although the Honourable Member has given us a little bit of a history of the act. And having said why they changed in the way they changed with the PLG, government changed at the time, he then goes on to say, well, they were not to be supporting this particular change for the reasons that they had set out. But in doing so, the Honourable Member talked of consultation with relevant stakeholders. I already mentioned that in the chief question, particularly relevant that at the time of the drafting and at the time of the publication of the bill, there was consultation, not just with the Chief Justice, who clearly has an interest, but also with Sir Paul Kennedy, who was the President of the, not just the Court of Appeals, but the President of the Court of Gibraltar at the time, and who had no objection to that bill. But it was, in any event, and it is, in any event, the fulfillment of a manifesto commitment. It was a manifesto commitment we gave in 2011, which had the support of the people of Gibraltar, and therefore we felt that it was right. And not only that, as has been mentioned, the Chief Justice of Gibraltar, we certainly consider to be not just an able Chief Justice, but certainly a very able member to lead the judiciary as head of the judiciary, as in fact had been the case prior to the Judicial Service Act, which was introduced by the previous administration. The only other thing, Mr. Speaker, I would say in the bill is in relation to the point raised by the Honourable Member about Section 37, which is the second link of this bill. The second purpose of this bill is not just, as I explained, not just to make the Chief Justice head of the judiciary, but to bring in additional provisions following the recommendations of the Judicial Service Commission in relation to disciplinary powers and proceedings concerning junior judicial officers in particular. As I mentioned during the course of my first intervention, Mr. Speaker, these amendments actually follow the advice that had been given to us by the Judicial Service Commission, and it is advice in relation to which we have clearly consulted the Chief Justice, who is happy with the provisions. And it involves also the deletion of that last paragraph in Section 37.1.2. Which talks about that the suspension is necessary for the maintaining of the judiciary. And it's important to note that what the section provides is that the governor may, in certain circumstances, suspend a person from a senior judicial office. So it's a discretion, and it's also acting on the advice of the commission. There are certain things that have to be shown because one of the three items in A, B, or C have to apply: criminal proceedings, serving a sentence, and convicted of a criminal offence. Any of those, and as currently drafted, it says, and in any of those circumstances, in addition, there has to be, if it's considered necessary for maintaining the confidence of the judiciary, that is supposed to be simply a constraint on the exercise of these discretion, because we have the various steps that have to be taken. Firstly, the commission has to consider the matter, and they should be seen to consider all the circumstances and all the relevant matters, which may include question of confidence, but they shouldn't be necessarily limited and constrained by that particular wording. So they would certainly consider everything in the round. And
doing so many
the process from judicial office, and again, in doing that, we consider the advice, and we consider, no doubt, everything from the in the line. So we have taken the recommendation of the Judicial Service Commission. We have agreed with their recommendation, and therefore we have set out the amendment that we propose for that particular. I can only go to that.
I'll now put a question to you. The bill for an act to amend the Judicial Services Act 2007 for the very second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Judicial Service Amendment Act 2015.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to give notice that the committee stage on third reading of the bill will be taken later today if all honourable members agree.
All honourable members agree that the committee stage on the third reading of the bill will be taken today.
Committee stage and third reading. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, can I join in congratulating all of those on the opposite side who have made their amazing speeches in the debate today? And have the honour to move that the House should resolve its present committee to consider the following bills clause by clause. Namely, the European Union Referendum Bill 2016, the Animal and Bird Amendment Bill 2016, and the Judicial Service Amendment Bill 2015.
Well, there are two matters which I think have to explain. First of all, to reiterate that honourable members may speak more than once on each individual clause if they so wish. Secondly, that we have been adopting the practice of late that where a number of amendments are going to be made, some of which are lengthy, and provided sufficient notice has been given of these amendments, we do not read them out fully in committee for each relevant clause, but we take them as having been read. That does not mean, however, that honourable members are not free to intervene at that stage and express a view, ask the question for clarification of the assembly.
A bill for an act to enable the full participation of Gibraltar in the United Kingdom's referendum on whether it should remain a member of the European Union and to provide for the making of subsidiary legislation in connection therewith and for matters connected thereto, including amending primary legislation by subsidiary legislation as the circumstances require. Clause 1. And part of the bill. Clause 2 as amended.
That is a small amendment to clause 2. Do honourable members agree that it should be incorporated into the clause?
Clause 2 as amended, and part of the bill.
Clause 3.
And part of the bill.
Clause 4 as amended.
That is a more substantial amendment to this clause. Do all members support the amendment?
Clause 4 as amended, stand part of the bill.
Clause 5.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 6 as amended.
Honourable members agree, as amended, stand part of the bill.
Clause 7 as amended.
Clause 7, that is a very minor amendment, and stand part of the bill. Clause 7. As amended, stand part of the bill.
Clause 8 as amended,
likewise a very minor amendment. Clause 8 as amended, stand part of the bill.
Clause 9 to 11,
verses 9 to 11, stand part of the bill.
Clause 12 as amended,
clause 12 as amended, stand part of the bill.
Clause 13,
clause 13, stand part of the bill.
Clause 14 as amended.
Clause 14 as amended, stand part of the bill.
Clause 15 as amended.
Clause 15 as amended, stand part of the bill.
Clause 16 as amended.
Clause 16 as amended, stand part of the bill.
Clause 17 to 19.
verses 17 to 19, and part of the bill.
Clause 20 as amended.
Clause 20 as amended, and part of the bill.
Clause 21 to 29.
And clause 27, and the clause is in favor. Insert the following clause out of clause 27, broadcasting from outside the vote.
Correct?
Okay. Clause 21 to 23.
Call the clause of Act 26, clause 21 to 26, stand part of the bill, and now clause 27 as amended.
27, there is a substantial amendment. All members agreed. Clause 27 as amended, stand part of the bill.
Clauses 28 to 29.
Clause 28 and 29, stand part of the bill.
Clause 30 as amended.
Clause 30 as amended, stand part of the bill.
Clauses 31 to 33.
Clauses 31 to 33, stand part of the bill.
Clause 34 as amended.
Clause 34, which is just clearing up 2016, as amended, stand part of the bill.
Clauses 35 and 36.
35, clauses 35 and 36, stand part of the bill.
Clause 37 as amended.
37, which is inserted in 2016, our federal regulations, as well as regulations, stand part of the bill as amended.
Clause 38,
clause 38, stand part of the bill.
The first schedule as amended.
There is an old page of amendment to the second first schedule. First schedule as amendment as amended, stand part of the bill.
Second schedule as amended.
Second schedule as amended, stand part of the bill.
The long title.
Long title also stands part of the bill.
A bill for an act to amend the Animal on Board Act. Clause 1.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 2 as amended.
Clause 2 as amended, stand part of the bill.
The long title.
The long title, stand part of the bill.
A bill for an act to amend the Judicial Service Act 2007. Clause 1.
Stand part of the bill.
No. May I amend Clause 1 by replacing 2015 with 2016 so that the act may be cited as the Judicial Service Act Amendment Act 2016?
Clause 1 as amended, and part of the bill.
Clause 2 and 3.
Clause 2 and 3, and part of the bill.
The long title.
And part of the bill.
The Honourable
Speaker, I have the honour to report that the European Union Referendum Bill 2016, the Animals and Birds Amendment Bill 2016, and the Judicial Service Amendment Bill 2015 have been considered in committee and agreed to with amendments, and I now move that they be read a third time and passed.
I now put a question, which is that the European Union Referendum Bill 2016. The Animals and Birds Amendment Bill 2016 and the Judicial Service Amendment Bill 2016 be read a third time and passed. I'm going to put the three of them to the vote. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
Private Member's Motion. The Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Speaker, I have the honour to move the motion standing my name, which reads as follows. This House believes that it is in the public interest the details of members, ministers, and office holders' licenses be published immediately on the parliamentary website and listed by way of annex in the annual estimate of income and expenditure when presented in all future budget sessions. Mr. Speaker, in bringing this motion to the House, I am conscious of the sacrifice that our predecessors have made, both in personal and financial terms, to also have the privilege to sit in this House today. It was in 1911 that Lord George, as Liberal Chancellor, introduced members' alliances in the mother of all parliaments in the United Kingdom. At that time, he stated that the money, and easily £400, was, and I quote, not a remuneration, it is not a recompense, it is not even a salary, it is just an allowance to enable us to open the door to great and honourable public service. However, 100 years later, after the UK MP dispenser scandal, Dominic Sandbrook, writing in the Mail Online in 2011, wrote, and I quote, MPs need to remember that they are servants of the people, never the masters. Mr. Speaker, I was reminded of this shortly after the election when a member of the public stopped me down Main Street and urged me never to forget that my parliamentary salary was now partly paid by taxes deducted from the lowest paid employees in Gibraltar, amongst others who couldn't all afford it. Mr. Speaker, I may be new to this House, but I'm not new to the world of finance and the need for financial disclosure and transparency. I find it incredible that details of the allowance that each receives, funded by the taxpayer, are not readily available on the parliamentary website, as is the case in the United Kingdom. Also, in May, members from parliamentary practice disclose this information in regard to the UK Parliament as a matter of course. You can see this on page 23 onwards of the 23rd edition. Mr. Speaker, my motion is in no way a criticism of this or any previous government. My motion is not in any way meant to be malicious or have any hidden intent. Mr. Speaker, my motion is simply that this Parliament should resolve the details of MPs and office holders' allowances to be published regularly on its website, available for all to see without the need for journalistic or parliamentary questions. Mr. Speaker, my motion goes to mention here the full detailed disclosure is made in the annual estimate book every year and not just the total of parliamentary allowances for members. And I ask, how can it be right that anyone can look up the salary of the Chief Secretary, £123,000, the Chief Justice, £132,000, the Financial Secretary, £123,000, in this annual estimate book, and yet the salary of the Chief Minister, or MP, is not made public in the same way. Mr. Speaker, those, put simply, are the reasons for my motion in requesting immediate full and transparent disclosure. Not by this for any future government that has been, but by conscious resolution of this House requiring mandatory publication on this Parliament's website and its disclosure in full future annual estimate. Mr. Speaker, this is not a matter for a select committee on parliamentary reform, but a matter of good government and common sense of parliamentarians and fulfilling our duty to taxpayers and the electorate. I trust the members opposite will have no problem in supporting our motion, which again, I say again, is directed solely at Parliament as a body and not at the government or its ministers. Mr. Speaker, with your leave, I hereby commend my motion to the House.
I now propose a question in the terms of the motion moved by the Honourable Adam Clute. Does any honourable member wish to speak on the motion?
the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, and can I thank the Honourable Member for the way in which he has put his speech. I'm grateful that he has indicated that this is not in any attempt, as it could not be, an attempt to attack the government. But, Mr. Speaker, can I just make clear for those who may be listening and for the purpose of the record that the salaries today are salaries fixed by a formula which was approved by the government majority, that made up of members opposite, in motion of the 17th of December 1998. Robert Emmanuel knows that when he gave notice of his motion, the government immediately acceded to the spirit of it and has now published on the website of the government, not of the parliament, of the government, the details of the parliamentary salaries. I have no objection to, once the IT department are able to find time to do so, there is a link from the parliament website to that part of the government website which sets out the details of those salaries. But can I just suggest to the Honourable Gentleman that he might wish in future, if he wants to move a motion like this, it's a matter entirely for him, to get in touch with the government, because the government would have been very receptive to a proposal from him, which would have resulted in exactly the same resolution, just as quickly in the posting of the relevant information on an easily accessible government website. What we have done, Speaker, is that we have provided the salaries as they are today. We have provided the salaries since 1996, showing how they have risen. We have provided the formula. I think we have set out the details of the handshake where the motion is, which is the 17th of December 1998, and the motion itself, so that everybody can see in what way the calculations are carried out. And I think it's easy for people to also read the motion which was passed at the time, which sets out that it was in fact the government at the time, not the House, that carried the day on that subject. Mr. Speaker, the servant of the people is a phrase often used in politics, not just from 2011. Andrew Rawnsley's excellent analysis of the new Labour government was called servant of the people, and the phrase comes from even earlier than that. It would be a fool who forgot that they are here, servants of the people. It would in fact be a fool in any part of our public sector who forgot that their salaries are paid by the taxpayer and that they must act always in continuity with their obligations to deliver not just value for money, but also to do so in a way which is commensurate with the remuneration they receive and their obligations to ensure that that service is provided properly. In this House in particular, we have a golden trust with the people who put us here to ensure that the work we do is in the best interest of this whole community, Mr. Speaker. Speaking for members on this side of the House, we never see ourselves as the masters. We see ourselves always as the servants. In fact, Mr. Speaker, I always remind people who refer to the number plate of the Chief Minister's car as Q1. But that is not the number plate of the first Gibraltarian. It is the number plate of the Gibraltarian elected to serve all 30,000. The person who works for the benefits of those 30,000, and a more fitting number plate might actually be 30,000 a month.
Does anyone honourable member wish to speak on the motion?
Right, before I sit down, as a result of all that, let's see how useful it is somebody of the ability to have attention to detail as the Deputy Commissioner. I would move the following amendment to the motion. Mr. Speaker, I read the whole motion as we propose it to be instead of just reading the amendment, but the motion should be as follows. The House welcomes that the government has listed the details of members, ministers, and office holders' allowances immediately on the government, in fact, just take out the word immediately as well, on the government website and listed by way of annex in the annual estimates of income and expenditure were presented in all future budget sessions, which is accurately reflect the position today.
speaker, members can have a photocopy of the written notice and I give of that amendment. Mr. Speaker, the amendment is proposed in order to reflect the position as it is today. The Honourable Member's motion is on the order paper because he filed it, and the House today need not pass that motion because it has already been given effect to. The House today can pass a motion that reflects the reality, which is that this information is now on the website.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Honourable Chief Minister's remarks. As regards the amendment to the motion, my original motion was directed to the House and not to the government, and therefore to welcome the fact that the government is present for twice is not really addressing my motion. My motion is directed to this House, so this House should resolve that as a body we consider that this information should be on a parliamentary website and not to the discretion of the government. So, I'm not quite sure that his amendment really reflects the spirit of what it was that I intended.
And having now received what the motion would look like if approved, I have to formulate what the actual amendment is. I'm going to do that. And the Chief Minister's amendment consists of the deletion. Would delete the Chief Minister's amendment, and this is the amendment that he has proposed and which I will now put to the House. The amendment deletes after the word House, the word, believe that it is in the public interest. It also deletes in the second line the word be published immediately and the word parliamentary, and in the case of, and after deleting the word parliamentary, that the word government should be substituted therefore. So the deletion, the motion, the amendment is that the word believe that in the public interest be deleted and substituted by the word welcome of the government as what? As something has listed the details, the word be published immediately be deleted, the word parliament be deleted and substituted by the word government. And therefore, the motion would then be this House welcomes that the government has listed the details of members, ministers, and office holders' allowances on the government website and listed by way of annex in the annual estimate of income and expenditure when presented in all future budget sessions. Any other member wish to speak on the amendment first? The Honourable Mr. Reitman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As I said before, the personal motion is directed to Parliament, not to the government. But it's hard to welcome the fact that the government has actually publicly detailed on its website, doesn't really address my original motion. Perhaps you can find a form of wording that this part welcomes the government has published on its website, but however believes that it means public interest of these allowances be also published immediately on the Parliamentary website and listed by way of annex and annex. I don't know if that has become an amendment to the amendment.
Any other honourable member wish to speak on the Chief Minister's amendment? I will then call upon the Chief Minister to exercise his right to reply on his amendment.
Mr. Speaker, I think this actually is a better way of ensuring that the House records the position as it is today, Mr. Speaker, and therefore that is why I've made this proposal. The House is always the party resolving; it's the party that is making the determination. But the House, in effect, is making a decision today to show something which is not necessary because the information has already been listed. And that is why I have proposed the amendment, and I wish to now proceed with it because it is approved.
I will now put the amendment moved by the Chief Minister to the vote. Those in favour?
Aye.
once again, carried. So the motion as amended, now reads, as I have read it previously, I'm not going to read it again. All honourable members may speak now to the motion as amended, other than the Chief Minister. And of course, the honourable Mr. Roy Clinton still has his right to reply at the end of it all.
Mr. Speaker, I beg your indulgence here. As I now say from the amended motion, I don't know why the amendment should be amended. I beg your indulgence, but when I now face the amendment to my original motion, I don't know why I can propose an amendment to the amended motion.
The answer is, Mr. Speaker, is you can propose an amendment to the amendment. Yes, you can. Oh, he has spoken on the amendment. Did he speak on the amendment? No.
He spoke on the amendment. He could make another amendment if he wishes. Any individual can get up and make any
amendment. Yes. The Chief Minister's can be further amended. And then we will have the amendment to the amendment. And to do my job properly, really, I should have the amendment in writing. Unless it's a very simple, it's a case of amendment.
Mr. Speaker, that is absolutely right. But of course, in a situation where the government amends without notice our motion, we don't know what the government.
What I'm saying is,
That because we don't know what the government is going to be saying or amending the motion until we actually see it in the course of the debate, it's going to be possible to do something on the spot. But I'm just discussing it with my honourable colleague, Mr. Clinton, because I do genuinely want this to go through by unanimous decision of the Parliament. And I do hear what Mr. Clinton has to say, really, which is a very valid point, which is that. Into all sorts of knots about who can speak and who cannot speak. If he now speaks until the amended motion, he won't be able to speak again.
Because I'm not going to be speaking on that. On the motion, I don't want to declare any controversy at this stage. All I want, Mr. Speaker, just a moment to share with my colleague, Mr. Clinton, in order to find a formal word that might be accepted to the Parliament. Because, as I say, I think that it's in the interest of everybody for this to be going through on the basis of consensus. It's a question that concerns us, just as parliamentary, the matter of Parliament, rather than the matter for the government. That's our responsibility.
Would honourable members like to speak to you, sir, for a few minutes?
Yes.
We'll discuss for a few minutes while the amendment is being formulated.
Am I correct in saying that the amendment to the amendment proposed by Mr. Roy, the Honourable Mr. Roy Clinton, adds a few words?
Yes, that would be correct.
And after the word website, the motion be amended by introducing, after the word website, the following words, and resolve that is spelled. That it should also be listed in the parliamentary website.
On the parliamentary website.
That it should also be listed on the parliamentary website. I will now put the amendment,
before you do, Mr. Speaker, and in order to avoid having to move an amendment to the amendment, would the honourable agree to move the amendment to the and resolve that they, because it's not an it.
Absolutely. instead of it. The amendment proposed is that after the word website, the following words should be added. And resolve that they should all be listed, also be listed on the parliamentary website. I will now put the amendment to the amendment to the House. All in favour? All right. The amendment is agreed. Any honourable member now wish to speak on the motion for the House? As amended. Is not. Mr. Kingston to reply.
Mr. Speaker, thank you very much for being very productive motion debate. I am grateful to the members representative to having accepted our motion as it was intended. Being new to this House, this is something which I will no doubt learn more about, but I would now, without any further ado, are you not reading it? put the motion to the House.
I will now put the motion to the House in the terms of the original motion moved by the Honourable Clinton, as amended by the Chief Minister, and as further amended by Mr. Clinton. All in favour? All agreed? Carried.
After a very convivial first 72 hours of parliamentary business, and having now found out, because I think because most people didn't know what the parliamentary salaries were, who has got the best part time job in Gibraltar, I have moved that the House is now adjourned as soon as ABA.
I now propose a question of this House is now adjourned as soon as ABA. I now put the question, which is that this House will now adjourn to the meeting. Are you in favour? All agree, the House will adjourn to the meeting.